further. Peacetime application, certainly. Then in the, after the Iranian had passed through the furnace, it would be taken back to the government for processing. And in that way, Thomas thought he saw a way for industry, for private enterprise, to participate in this program and to offset the high capital cost by the reduction in the X over 2 that Brown refers to, reduction in the cost of petroleum to the government.
Well, actually, industry would be playing only a minor role in that whole picture, it seems to me.
Isn't there a parallel, Sopseg, with what's happening down in the Tennessee Valley? Dr. Thomas's own company is making elemental phosphorus there with power generated at Muscle Shoals. That power is a byproduct, so the politicians tell us
of... Of course, the users of the power would be private industry, but I'm thinking of the private industry that has to get into the picture and put up the capital to develop a plant for producing and distributing the power with huge government subsidies. And I think they're government subsidies because unless the government were in the picture, I don't think industry would be at all interested in getting into it.
I think perhaps that is true, but the same statement goes for the railroads. When the railroads were built across the continental United States, the government gave extensive grants of land to the railroads to give them additional incentives to put their tracks over the Rocky Mountains. Same thing has been true with the airlines. They have a subsidy, as it what it is, for carrying air mail. And the same thing is true here. It would be a subsidy to company for the production of plutonium. And in fact, our steel industry, you might say, grew up under a subsidy of a high protective tariff. And it's common policy of this country to grant subsidies of either direct or indirect natures to the various industries who are developing new uses for our raw materials.
So would you say that industry has manifested a great interest in getting into this field of nuclear power development?
I would say yes, if you use as an indication of that interest the amount of energy that industry is putting forth to have their story heard and coming forward with proposals for getting into the picture.
How much information, Kirkpatrick, does industry have about atomic development?
Well, I think I would take a little exception with what Brown said there. 2 years ago, the commission appointed, as you recall, an industrial advisory group headed by Mr. James Parker of Detroit, at that time president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, Dr. Robert Wilson of Standard Oil, Dr. Egloff, a number of Chicago citizens were on that very important committee. At that time, they reported that they had the feeling anyway that there was a vast fund of information that would be helpful to industry in participating in the program if that were made available. Subsequently, the commission appointed a group, an ad hoc committee on technological information, which has been studying the patent files and more recently one of the projects, complete project at Oak Ridge. We find in the main that the commission is releasing and declassifying this information, that there is not this vast fund that the Parker Committee referred to. On the other hand, I feel very strongly that until industry gets a better look into the problems of the commission and the problems of the atomic energy program, we can't have this full participation that is the desirable thing that we need.
Well, do you think they ought to get that better look?
I think they should.
Well, isn't it true, Kirkpatrick, that even those industries that have had large contracts with the Atomic Energy Commission for operating commission properties haven't shown too much eagerness to invest private capital in atomic energy development?
Well, I think that is perhaps true. A relatively small group that has.
But they have had an intimate look at it.
That is.
Brown? Well, all of those contracts have been what we call cost-plus contracts. And in many ways, if you give a company a cost-plus contract, it becomes a sort of a parasite industry. It's not a free industry in the sense of free enterprise. On the other hand, if we can get the private enterprise to come forward with a proposal to build a reactor for the purpose of producing plutonium and power, and build that reactor on a lump sum basis, and then process the material to produce plutonium on a unit price basis, and allow that company to retain any profits that accrue due to their efficient operation of the plant, then we have free enterprise in the picture. And I think that is what Dr. Thomas had in mind, and that's substantially what he proposed.
Well, in the Thomas proposal, wasn't there one other point, namely that if government found that any of these, shall we say, restricted things such as fissionable materials are being misused, then government could come in and shut down the plant?
Well, government can do that in any industry of any kind.
They always have the power in wartime
to come in and shut down.
Even in peacetime, though, I should think that that might possibly be invoked, and under those conditions, I doubt whether industry would be too keen to get into it.
Well, I think we can offer all kinds of reasons why industry might not wish to get into it, but the only way to prove the thing is to give them a chance to come in by asking for a proposal. And if they come forward with proposals, I think that's the proof of the pudding.
I think you'd be surprised to see how many of them will come.
Well, how has industry received this Thomas plan that we've been talking about? Or has that had much currency outside your circles? Scientific circles.
I doubt very much if industry has really had an opportunity to study it. Personally, I would like to encourage industry to study those proposals and see what they can come up with. And I have hopes that they will be given that opportunity.
Well, now, we're talking about the government role in this business and the role of private enterprise. I think the general public would be interested in the location of these power plants that you gentlemen are talking about. What if one blows up? Is there any danger that they'll contaminate the atmosphere, or contaminate nearby waters? How about that, Daniel?
Atomic Energy Commission has adopted a very conservative policy on this matter, and rightly so. No large reactor can be operating near to cities. There's a proving ground established out in Idaho. But I think that after a little practice in Idaho, then it'll turn out that it'll be quite safe to put these plants near cities. Obviously, we couldn't do it until we try these pilot plants.
You don't think that practice in Idaho will be hard on our listeners in Idaho?
No, no. I think there's a very little danger. You certainly won't get an atomic explosion under any condition. The worst that could happen would be something that goes into a boiler explosion with the serious addition of radioactive material. But I think these can be kept under control. I think it is true, was it not, that when automobiles came in, many conservatives were afraid of sitting on top of 10 gallons of gasoline?
Yes, I imagine that was the case. Are you as sanguine about these dangers as Daniel's?
Oh, yes. I think development has already proceeded pretty far so that we can say that there is relatively little danger even now if a reactor is properly built and under good automatic control.
I'd like to make one more point before we close. Think in terms of plutonium only for atomic bombs. We must realize that when the world really gets into a proper state of peace, that we can use this stockpile of atomic bombs for peacetime power. 1 pound goes into a train load of coal, theoretically.
Well, now, how about the supply of uranium, Daniels? I take it that all of these developments that we're talking about stem from that, shall I call it a chemical, from uranium, an element. How about the supply of uranium?
Well, I'm not prepared to say. From pre-war estimates, there wasn't enough uranium to be very significant for power purposes. But the uranium wasn't very much sought after. Intensive prospecting is going on now. I would be surprised if we don't find new deposits and ways of using more low-grade ore.
Brown,
why, I am not sure how accurate estimates might be, but estimates have been made that indicate the heat that can be obtained from nuclear reactors operating on plutonium based on the estimates as to the availability of uranium would indicate that the heat that can be obtained would be approximately equal or would exceed
the heat that has been obtained and is to be obtained from our petroleum reserves throughout the world. That gives us a sort of an order of magnitude by which we can gauge things.
Well, now, is that uranium that you're discussing available to us?
Well,
where is it anyway?
Or are you prepared to say? Well, uranium is found at various places all over the earth in small areas where it can be recovered according to present methods. And just as we have to drill deeper and deeper for oil as the years go by, we may have to use leaner and leaner ores of uranium as the years pass.
Well, now, gentlemen, this has been an exceedingly interesting discussion. I take it that if we are to look forward practically to these peacetime developments, heat and power, it is going to be a partnership between government and private enterprise. Is that put it correctly, Brown?
I think that is necessary at least for some time.
And if the government will be in the business to produce atomic bombs, and as a byproduct of those bombs, we might reasonably look forward to the use of atomic energy for heat and power.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand's discussion, Peacetime Uses and Problems of Atomic Energy. You can obtain a copy of today's discussion and an extensive list of books and articles about the subject by sending 10 cents in coin to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. That address again, the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were Farrington Daniels, former chairman of the Board of Governors for the Aragon National Laboratories and professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin, George Granger Brown, director of engineering with the Atomic Energy Commission, Sidney B. Kirkpatrick, editorial director of Chemical Engineering and Chemical Industries, and Paul E. Klopstig, director of research at the Institute of Technology, Northwestern University. Next week, the Reviewing Stand presents a discussion of the question, what should be our national water policy? Our guest speakers will be Julian Hines, general manager of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, W.W. Horner, consulting engineer from St. Louis and past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, T.R. Howson, consulting engineer from Chicago, and Thorndike Seville, dean of engineering at New York University. The Northwestern Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Today, the program was transcribed. Your announcer has been Marshall Kent. This is the World Series Network, the Mutual Broadcasting System.